Welcome to Novelist Spotlight. This is Mike Consul, your host. This is where we cogitate with published fiction writers. We learn about their practices, their best practices or worst practices. We learn about what inspires them, and we learn from them so that we can be better writers ourselves and learn the whys and wherefores of what really works. And I've never said this before, but I have an extra special guest today, and I want to tell you why. You already know her name. Her name is Mer Lafferty because it's in the headline. But what makes her extra special? Well, some of us do a podcast. She does three. Okay, some of us have written books. She's written, I don't know how many, but we're going to find out. But I will also tell you that I subscribe to one of her podcasts, which is I Should Be Writing. And it was her podcast that inspired me to do this. And I'm a guy who's done 1,000 podcasts previously for the, you know, the company I work for. I'm a magazine editor, and I've done tons of podcasts. But when I listened to Mer, she inspired me to do this. We never talked. This is the first time we're going to be talking, but just listening to her inspired this kind of different approach to podcasting. And then when I decided I was going to do Novelist Spotlight, I went out there to look at, well, who's out there besides Mer who is doing what I want to do, which is really speaking to fiction writers and talking about what it's all about and how to get it done and so on. And in the course of doing that little bit of research, I ran across one of them where the guy said, this podcast was inspired by Mer Lafferty. And I'm thinking, okay, well, that makes two. She's already inspired at least. And her podcast is just fun. I don't know her other two. I mean, I haven't listened to Ditch Diggers or Escape Pod. I mean, she's got three different ones, at least three. And I don't know how she gets it all done, but we're going to find out. I'll tell you just a little bit about Mer before I allow her to speak. Mer Lafferty is a podcaster, as you know, an author and an editor. She's been recording and producing podcasts since when we had dial-up. I think she was podcasting. I mean, 2004, I guess maybe we had broadband then, but I mean, think about that. 2004, she's been podcasting for a long time. She has won the Podcast Peer Award. She's won a Hugo Award. She's been inducted into the Podcast Academy Hall of Fame. That was in 2015. Her book titled Six Wakes was a finalist for the Hugo, Nebula, and Philip K. Dick Awards. And the novelization of Solo, a Star Wars story, was nominated for the Scribe Award. On the editing side, she was a founding co-editor of Pseudopod, the horror podcast, and currently is co-editor of Escape Pod, nominated this year for two Hugo Awards. Best Semiprazine, I don't even know I'm pronouncing that correctly, but Mer can check me on that. And Best Short Form Editor, along with her co-editor. She is in the Raleigh-Durham Triangle area of North Carolina. I'm coming to you from California, from Northern California, East San Francisco Bay. Mer Lafferty, I'm exhausted just thinking about your schedule. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Mike. Thanks for having me.
You know, I'm so glad that you were able to take the time. Let me begin with these podcasts that you do. As I said, I understand I Should Be Writing. It's the podcast for wannabe fiction writers. You make that very clear. Really enjoy listening to you on there. But you also have one called Ditch Diggers and another called Escape Pod. Can you go ahead and, for our listeners and for me, talk what each of those podcasts are looking to accomplish or what their focus is?
Sure. Ditch Diggers is a show I started with my good friend Matt Wallace, who's also an author. And we wanted to, to start with, I Should Be Writing is a very kind and supportive podcast for anybody who has social anxiety or fear of rejection or all the things that stop people from going for a creative career because they're not good enough or self-doubt or someone told them one time that they'll never write, et cetera, which has its place. But we realized in 2015, I think, 2015, that no one was saying what to do once you start getting published. And so one thing we discovered is that when you become a author for money, you can't afford the luxury of writer's block because there's lots of people who go to work every day. And if they don't feel like doing their job, well, tough. They got to do their job. Ditch diggers can't get ditch digger block. So we called the show Ditch Diggers to talk about the business side of writing, everything from firing your agent, how to choose an agent mid-career, how to manage social media, what happens when your editor quits, all those sorts of things. So Ditch Diggers is more about the business side, and it's a little ruder, and we swear on it. Well, we don't swear on I Should Be Writing. And Escape Pod is a fiction magazine where we publish one science fiction story a week. We started out doing it audio, and now we buy ebook rights as well to do it, to print the stories on our homepage. So we've been doing that since 2005. I've not been involved with Escape Pod the whole time, but I think I've been co-editor with Divya for 5 years now, I think. That sounds right. So yeah, my SB Divya is my co-editor. And so we were doing, and it's semi-pro zine. It's a magazine that is semi-pro according to the World Science Fiction Society's rules, which is a certain number of magazines published per year that pay their staff and pay the author. So that's how we qualify. And we were up for the Hugo last weekend. We did not win.
Now, was that where you were at WorldCon? Was that where the Hugo Award was given out? Is that
yes.
the case?
So
you just got back from DC where WorldCon was held, you were saying before we started recording.
Right.
Now, did you get to go? I have to tell you, I was in the car with my wife. I forget where we were driving. We were out of town. And I said, you have to listen to Murr. This is a podcast that I subscribe to. And you had been at some other event. And this kind of dovetails with the fact that you didn't win the Hugo at WorldCon. But you were talking about how much fun you had at the event. And you said but they had, so I couldn't go to the winner's party because I didn't win. But I got to go to the loser's party. So we had fun at the loser's party. My wife and I both just burst out laughing. You had to be there to have listened to Murr tell the story, but she was all excited. You were all excited. It was just a fun time. And one of the things I really like about I Should Be Writing is that you're very personal on there. Personal in the sense that you talk about yourself and your own struggles and just the challenges that you run into in life. You also aren't afraid of silence. You allow some breathing room in between your statements. It's pretty clear that when you start recording, there are times when you are just, you know, you're grappling for thoughts. And when I say grappling, I don't mean like they're random nonsense thoughts. I just mean that you're giving yourself time to connect thoughts. You do a lot of thought association, word association, perhaps.
Right. I don't script.
Yeah, you don't script. Exactly. I guess that's the easy way of saying it is you don't script. So you just know what you want to talk about. Basically, you have a subject to talk about. Did you set out that way right from the beginning, or is this a style you developed?
From the very beginning, I was trying to build any sort of writing career in 2004. But the one place I knew you could sell personal essays was NPR, and they weren't interested in the stories of a geeky mother with a toddler. And but I thought I was doing pretty well with writing them. So I found out about podcasting. So I decided to use the podcast to read my essays that I was writing. And so that was kind of scripted, except I talked around it about whatever was on my mind. And then I started I Should Be Writing the following year, where I just wanted to talk. You know, I've got ADHD and I am not good with lots and lots of prep. I will get bored and not do it. If I told myself I had to script, I would script a couple of times and then I would stop. That I'm pretty sure that's exactly what would happen. So unless I ever hire a producer who's actually able to tell me I have deadlines and crack a whip over me, I just talk about what's on my mind. And usually, now that I've started live streaming the podcast, the audience input really helps guide that, especially if I open it up by telling them, hey, guys, I had a bad day. I don't know what I'm going to talk about. Can you help me? And they always do. So I'm very grateful for them.
So ADHD is actually, would you not say that having ADHD can actually be an asset for a writer, for a fiction writer in particular, perhaps?
Yeah, I didn't see that for a long time, but I realize one thing that comes with ADHD, which isn't always the best, is hyperfocus. So I can hyperfocus and get several thousand words written in a day if I can get into that zone. And apparently, even though we've been told it's bad to do this, and it's often multitasking is something ADHD people can do, because sometimes focusing on one thing is quite boring, so they want to do something else at the same time. So there are some assets. I know a lot of creative people who have ADHD, and I think that it may go hand in hand, just because your mind is going lots and lots of different places almost all the time, and that can be where ideas come from.
Exactly. Yeah, and I have never been diagnosed that way, but I know that I have a short attention span. If somebody says something, and I suddenly start following this thread of thought, and then I leap to something else, and I'm thinking, you know, I need to pay stricter attention when people are talking to me, or I'm watching a movie or whatever, or reading a book for that matter. But on the other hand, I like the monkey mind for certain tasks, such as writing. Now, you've written a lot of material. How many books have you written now? What are you up to?
Published, I have 6. Yeah, I have 6. 2 in another IP, intellectual property, and 4 of my own. One of them was a small press book that's out of print now. Oh, but it's still available via ebook. But I've done several novellas. When I started, a couple of people started podcasting and serializing their fiction. Anyone listening, if you ever see a news report about how some famous author is suddenly using podcasting for this new thing to serialize their books, we were doing it in 05. We just weren't famous. So Scott Sigler and T. Morris started doing publishing their fiction like that. And I had a fear because of rights, because editors want to buy things from you that you have not sold or given away the rights elsewhere. So if you post a story on your blog, well, that's first English worldwide rights right there. You just gave it away. I'm not saying it's bad. I'm just saying this is something I knew, and I didn't know if I could build a writing career by giving away stuff and thereby giving the rights away. But we did find out that if you get a big enough following by either self-publishing on Kindle or just giving away stuff on your site, you can still get book deals. I've never got a book deal for the stuff that I did podcast early on, but I did build an audience and make a name for myself that led to future perks creatively.
So how many of your books are self-published versus traditional? Or are you entirely self-published? And especially since you have a following, and obviously self-publishing gives you a greater share of any sale.
Right. I have a number of novellas that are self-published. My novel Playing for Keeps that was short, that was small press published, and they only bought the print rights, which I think they greatly regretted, because that was around 2007 when the ebook thing started to take off. And then I self-published my book Six Wakes in non-North American English-speaking territories like England, UK, Australia, South Africa. When you sell worldwide English rights, that's what it covers. And the book was nominated for a bunch of awards and sold pretty well, but nobody in Britain wanted to publish it. So I gave it a little bit of time, and then finally, like, okay, I'm going to self-publish it. So if you are worldwide, you can maybe get it that way. I did not, t- to self-publish the audio, which means I would have to read the book over again because I narrated the first time and I was not willing to do that. So sorry, no audiobook is available via self-publish. But so yeah, you could, it gets a little squirrely when the book is published by a publisher in one place and you have to self-publish another place. But so it's six novellas, the ebook of a small press book I have, and then the ebook of my last science fiction book are self-published in one way or another.
Now, you are on Audible as well, besides being on bookselling platforms around the whole ecosphere of publishing. You're on Audible, and you made the decision, in some cases anyway, to read your own book. Talk about why you decided to do that. What do you think the advantages of reading your own book is vis-a-vis hiring somebody to do that, or somebody doing it in return for some points on the book or what have you?
Well, I learned, I had to narrate it early on when I was serializing my fiction. I was the one producing the podcast, so I was not making any money writing and no money podcasting, so I wasn't going to start paying people to read my stuff when I could do it just fine myself. And I got used to it and I enjoyed it. So because my audience knew me mostly audibly, my first publisher also hired me to narrate my own books. So I didn't produce them, but I did go to a separate soundstage in Raleigh to record, but I was the narrator all the times through. The benefits are, you know how everything is supposed to be pronounced, especially in science fiction. That comes in very handy. Some people aren't good at reading aloud. It is true. I mean, people say, I prefer when the author reads it because they know what everything sounds like. That doesn't mean they can convey it well. Some people are amazing audiobook narrators, like Mary Robinette Kowal, who does, I believe she does her own books, but also she hires out to do other people's books. And I've seen her read in person, and it is a different experience when she reads than when a lot of other authors read in person. But I'd like to think I'm in the middle. I'm not as dynamic as Mary Robinette, and I'm not as wooden as some other authors are. But because I came up doing it, I do enjoy it. What's funny is my newest novella, The Ophelia Network, I was going to narrate it, but I can't sing, and there are songs in there. So they hired someone who could sing. So that was a little disappointing, but I mean, I was not going to sing on an audiobook that would be there forever for people to listen to. No way.
You know, I started reading chapters from one of the books I've written. You know, I distinguish between, I've got four manuscripts and then I've got a novel, a self-published novel, but I got four manuscripts. I don't call them books or novels until they're actually published. And I still have hope that they'll go to the traditional route perhaps, but you know, I might go self-publishing. But I started to, as you were saying, serialize. And as I started reading, I was starting to bore myself a little bit. So, and then I kind of convinced myself to read a little bit more loosely. And what I ended up doing is not reading it word for word. I ended up starting to actually introduce some extra language into it. And then I started to realize, this is how I actually should be writing. I should write something, but then read it out loud. I mean, we're all told, read it out loud and see what it sounds like. But normally people think in terms of, well, read it word for word and see what it sounds like. But when I actually allowed myself the freedom to read it, like I was just sitting at the bar having a beer with a friend, I felt like it became more dynamic, like it opened it up. And then I started thinking, this is how I have to write, you know, when I think I'm done with the chapter, read it aloud in this fashion, record it, and then rewrite the chapter in a way that makes it more conversational and maybe a little bit more personal. So I don't know if you've had that experience or not, or do you read your stuff aloud when you are, that the old rule, read it out loud and see what it sounds like and then decide whether or not it needs a rewrite?
No, I'm absolutely one of those hypocrites who says that this is the best way to find mistakes in your writing and you should do it. But then I don't do it because usually I'm right up against a deadline and can't afford the time. Reading the chapter out loud like chapter by chapter might be a good move. But you really do catch a lot of things. You catch when a sentence doesn't sound right, and you catch when you've just made a mistake. You catch misspellings because you have to focus on every single word because you're reading them. And it's kind of scary to think about what you overlook when you're reading because of all the things you catch when you're reading aloud. I discovered, and this was final draft. This is my editor, my copy editor, and I had been over the book many times. One of my chapters didn't have a title. And every other chapter did. And it was because I split the book into parts. And so you got the page that says like part two, and then you turn the page and there's the next chapter. And the next chapter didn't have a title because I guess because everybody saw part two and thought, oh, that's the chapter title. And they kept going. So that was really annoying, frankly. I'm like, oh man, I didn't catch it. Nobody else caught it. But then again, no readers ever complained, so I don't know. So yeah, it really, really is a good way to hear how the words sound. It slows you down, forces you to pay attention to the work. And it's a useful tool, only it takes a lot of, I think it's the ADHD thing again. It bores me. It bores me to read just for myself, just for my own benefit. And I'm not recording. It's like, when is this over? I'll just read faster and skip things, which is exactly what I'm trying to avoid doing.
Right. You know, I get it. What about your writing regimen? How do you, I mean, you should be writing according to your own podcast, and yet you're talking to me when you really should be writing. What is your writing regimen, Mer?
Like, ideally?
Yeah, go ahead.
Ideally, it's early in the morning. I like to get up and get settled, do a little exercise, grab my coffee, and then sit down to start writing. I've started doing a co-writing group on Google Meet with some other writer friends. So we all just get on and as if we're sitting at a table writing together. And that actually helps with accountability. In a perfect world, I get writing done in the morning and then I'm able to do other things. I usually stream in the afternoons. 4 days a week. And it's hard sticking to a schedule, but I was doing a really good job before Worldcon. And now it's like, it's the holidays and my kid is home and I'm actually able to take a break from everything. So I did get up.
You're taking a break.
Sorry.
So you're taking a break right now, but yeah. Typically in the morning when you get up, first of all, what kind of exercise? I mean, do you exercise for the purpose of just getting the blood flowing and really kind of waking up so that you're energized enough to do some energetic writing?
Is this just part of your
exercise is good for me, so I'm going to do it and then I'll get to the writing. Or is it part of the writing process for you, the kind of the setup?
It's not really part of the writing process. It is, I'm in my late 40s and realizing when I'm looking at older people, what happens to your body when you don't exercise. And so I'm in the, I really need to get my bones and my heart and my endurance in shape now. No more waiting. No picking up a habit and then dropping it. I do indoor cycling in the morning. I bought a trainer for your bike that turns your regular bike into a exercise bike. You know, it lifts the back wheel and counts. It judges how fast you're going. Wow. And then I got a subscription to Zwift, which will take the data from your trainer and put you in a virtual bike ride with people all over the world, and you'll see the list of who's around you, and you're just riding your bike through, you know, Central Park or in England, Hyde Park. And it's really an interesting way of doing it, especially, you know, since I'm in my basement. It is a way to focus on your exercise, even though you're still looking at a screen. It's you're at least knowing that your exercise is connected rather than just zoning out on a TV show or something. But So yeah, and I do try to do yoga at night. So, but this is a new regimen started literally this month. So it's going to take a while to build back up to that. But yeah, it's pretty important to me right now.
Now, how many, ideally, how much time do you spend each morning? If you were to block out an amount of time and it's like, this is what I want to commit to each morning, how long would you be writing for?
How long would I be writing? About 2 hours, ideally. Mm-hmm.
And that's on to other things because you've got podcasts to do. I think you're running you also have a blog.
I really don't update the blog. Let's be serious.
You know, okay. And you know, with the podcast, I noticed like when I'm listening to, I should be writing, there are times when you've said, hey, it's been a while. I'm back.
Yeah.
Been busy with this, been busy with that. That's part of how you make it personal that people really, you give people kind of a looking glass into your life. And it's just, hey, it was time to do another one. So here I am and I'm going to talk about this or that. You're also on Twitch. I think that's fairly new. What's the advantage to being on Twitch? I mean, that allows for video so people can see you talking at the same time. So what's the advantage?
It's really interesting and a little sad. August of last year, I started messing around on Twitch, just having fun. And then I started moving my podcast there and trying to get my podcast audience to tune in. And I had strict goals. I had stuff written down. I was doing all of the things they tell you to do to set and achieve your goals, blah, blah, blah. And I changed how I do the podcast. I changed how I delivered the podcast to my Patreon supporters. I changed, for me, it was a lot more fun and more dynamic and I enjoyed it more. And I think that came across in the audio. And oh, and I went to 2 times a week, and because Twitch is scheduled and it's a much bigger deadline than I got to do a podcast. I'm late. I'll do one now and apologize for not being on for a while. It's like, no, I told people I will do a podcast at this time twice a week. So I better get on and do it. So it kept me consistent. I did, I think, 85 episodes this month. And not this month. God,
wow.
Sorry. This year. 85 episodes this year. And I'd also cleaned up my archives last winter. And I started to see, like, there were some years I did not get a lot of episodes out. But this year, this 2021, I got more I Should Be Writing recorded than ever before in a year. And I'm very proud of that. The interesting thing was the marker didn't move much. Not in downloads, listeners, Patreon support. It didn't go down, but it didn't move much. So I've been kind of frustrated and trying to figure out what went wrong there. But what it did do, I'll say it again, is that it made me more interested in doing this show that I've done since 2005. And I'm pretty sure I've said everything I can say. But as you said, I am very personal in my show. And I do that on purpose because there's so many people who, once they succeed in their career, they make it look easy. And they want to project that polished, professional creator look. But
what's
anyway,
interesting is, to just piggybacking on what you were just saying, is that you're not trying to project this polished, everything is antiseptic sort of production, but despite that, there is a level of professionalism. There's a relaxation there. There's a familiarity there that, it's professional in its own way. And then it's like, I can just sit here unscripted, talk to you, come out with useful information, make it pleasing to you. So you don't need to, you don't worry about being perfect. You don't worry about the dog coming in. You don't worry about, I've just finished that sentence and there's going to be, 10 seconds of silence before I start talking again because I'm capturing my next thought and formulating it. It works very well. I mean, would you not agree that it's a different kind of professionalism? And certainly you're very experienced at this because you've been doing it for a long time.
Yeah, I did a little bit of radio with a friend of mine, like you know, local access, talk about science fiction once a month kind of thing. And luckily it was with a partner, because when I would get quiet, my first thought was, oh God, I can't cut this out, or I can't do anything to make this sound better. And then I get on that mindset instead of actually thinking about what to say next. It's like, oh God, the silence has gone on longer, and it's gone on longer, and it's still going on. And I don't do that when I podcast. If it's too long, then I'll edit it out, or my producer, I have a audio producer, she'll edit it out. But my goal is mainly to tell people that whatever fears or hurdles or blocks in your way that you see to getting a creative lifestyle, you're not alone. Almost everybody's felt it. I can't say everybody, because I got to leave some holes for some perfect people out there. But seriously, I know of very experienced writers who contact their agent in the middle of every book and go, I'm afraid this is absolute crap. I'm so sorry. I don't know what I'm going to do. There's people who, you know, they stumble. They put out a book that's not as good, and they think my career's over, but they keep writing. And persistence is the biggest thing. So even if you get a rejection, you cry, you feel like crap, you think you're the worst writer in the entire world, you think that the editor has taken your name and put it on a blacklist just because you are so bad, you will never, ever get better. Everybody's felt that. And so I tried to bring in my stumbles, my struggles with ADHD and depression. And, you know, my kid is in college now, but, you know, I've been podcasting through most of their life. So I'm able to talk about being a parent of a young child and wanting to write. So there's, that's why I don't go for like polished scripted. That's why I go for personal, because honestly, I don't expect everybody to go back. I said I've repeated myself. Obviously, I don't have anything new to talk about in writing, really. But I know people aren't going to go back to the totally bad produced episode one. I hope they never do. I know some people who do, and I am baffled. But some people want to hear me before I ever sold a story, and then, you know, listen up to where I'm an award-winning novelist. And I'm really glad I chronicled that, actually. I don't ever want to go back to listen to it, but I'm glad I know where it is. So
yes, it's exactly. There. It's like keeping a journal, but it's an audio journal. And you've helped people along the way. And that's exactly really what I take from I Should Be Writing is, you know, you mentioned the word persistence, and that is absolutely crucial to anybody who wants to actually finish a manuscript and hopefully get it published or have a writing career. You must be persistent. And you really make it very clear, you know, as I've listened to you over time, make it very clear that there's all these hurdles. There's always going to be stumbling blocks. You're always going to run into certain things. And a bad day of writing is a reason to be depressed. Okay. I mean, it's what people do. In reality, we should just realize you just be persistent. You do the work. You keep the faith and you keep writing, and good things will happen. But you come out of a bad day of writing. I mean, I didn't understand what people meant by the temperamental artist until I started writing. It's kind of like, hey, you're temperamental because if you've had a bad day, you didn't feel like you were very productive, or you produced, but it wasn't of any real quality, you don't feel very good that day.
No.
Now, over time, I think this probably has been your experience too. Over time, you start to realize, just trust the process. And if you've had a bad day, just move on to other things. And tomorrow is a new day, and it will work over time.
Yeah. To go back to what I was saying is, even though I've been doing this for so long and I know I'm repeating myself, people aren't going to go back to the beginning, but also I am not a doctor. I got to say that I'm not a doctor, but I am honest about my struggles with mental illness. And every so often I will get an email from somebody who said, you know, I listened to you and I thought I'm a little bit like you. So I went to my doctor and I got diagnosed and I'm getting help and I'm so happy now. And that is what keeps me going. Really. Mm-hmm. It's like not only hearing that I had my first sale or I just got an award nomination or a movie deal. It's also, you helped me get better and, you know, mentally. And when you're mentally better, I didn't start podcasting until I got on antidepressants. I know the date. I started getting antidepressants November of 2004, and December is when I started podcasting because I suddenly felt better. I think it's very important to not suffer for your art, but instead to take care of yourself, and then you'll feel a lot better about creating. But I'm sorry, I wanted to finish that thought, and I forgot what you just said about. Sorry. Well,
I was talking about the persistence and
right.
And yes.
Yes, yes. So I know several good authors. Or I should say good writers, because they're not authors because they quit. They're excellent. They either got discouraged or, decided to convince themselves that the cards are stacked against them. And there's a secret to getting published that no one told them. And I know people who aren't as good writers as those people, but they're published because they persisted. Every time you write something, you get better. And it may not be obvious that you're getting better. It's a slow thing. But even if you write something bad, you're still learning from it. I remember I had a dream one time, and I became obsessed with the dream, and I really wanted to write it in a story. And I wrote it, and it was bad. I like sent it to a critique partner, and he's just like, you know, he said it very constructively, obviously. But essentially, he's like, yeah, this is not your best work by far. But I was glad I got it out of my head and I learned from that. So that's why I tell people, it's like, even if you started writing crap, try to finish it, because that will teach you something as well. But one of the things that I feel extremely strongly about is the fact that I know rejections suck. I know it. I'm rejected sometimes. It still happens. But only working writers get rejected. You know, if you're not trying to build your career, if you're not sending out submissions, you are not a working writer. So when you start sending out submissions, you're a working writer. You're not getting paid yet, but you're doing the job. The first job is writing. Second job is finishing. Third job is submitting. So when you are doing those three things, you're a working writer. So I feel very strongly, again, I'm not a doctor, I'm not a psychiatrist, but I know, at least for me, processing grief. And yeah, when you get rejected, that's some grief right there. It sucks. Processing your grief is very important. I personally allow myself one afternoon/evening of just feeling bad. I feel bad. I'm going to feel sorry for myself. I'm going to get some wine. I'm going to play a computer game. I'm just going to let that process. And the next day, I find it easier to go back to work. And I've noticed if I don't give myself that time, it's a lot harder to get back to work. So I feel very strongly about both. If you get rejected, just remind yourself you're a working writer. You're doing the job.
That's a great strategy, which you just said. That's a great strategy. I mean, allowing yourself to, you know, the full range of emotions, allowing, you know, creating the full circle. I mean, you don't want to try to hold everything at bay. If you're feeling it, go ahead and experience it. Don't let it dominate your life. But you've set aside this time to for whatever it is, self-pity, for self-reflection, for meditation, whatever you want to call it. And I want to ask you about, so pre-antidepressant days, back in the dark days, have you pulled from those dark days? Have you created characters and scenes, or maybe even entire novels that were informed by those dark times?
I don't think I've written about depression before.
Not necessarily depression, but just a dark character, perhaps, or somebody who's in a mood that's somewhat reflective of what you recall from the past.
Not directly. Okay. It probably has influenced me. I mean, you're influenced by everything in your life, and I didn't even realize that my first mainstream book was heavily influenced by some books I read when I was a teenager until a review mentioned it. And I'm like, how did I not consciously think about this? How? It was so weird knowing that I had internalized those books so deeply that they were influencing my writing. I didn't even know. So I'm sure it has, but not consciously.
Well, when you say first mainstream book, so previous to that, what were those avant-garde writing experiments you were doing?
Well, I did the novellas I mentioned on my podcast, and I self-published those via ebook as well. I sold my first novel in 2007, which was small press, and that's out of print now. It's still in print via ebook. In 2013, my first book from one of the big, God, how many are there now? Four? I don't know. What are the big publishers, you know, with a full advance?
There's another merger that, although that's being fought by the Justice Department right now.
Yeah.
Simon & Schuster and Penguin.
Right. So, but anyway, one of those big ones was when I mentioned the mainstream book, the time I could actually expect to see my book on the shelves. I actually got reviews in Library Journal and Kirkus. So that happened in 2013. So that's the timeline.
Talk about the interplay between podcasting and writing. You have a following with your podcasting. That following must translate into, for instance, you know, Merce talking about the Ophelia Network, her forthcoming novella. I'm going to pre-order it now. Do you find what do you find just in terms of how the two have perhaps a symbiotic relationship, but maybe beyond what I just said?
Well, it's interesting because by podcasting, I used to do a lot of interviews with authors. And by podcasting, I didn't realize I was building a network. I was networking as I was interviewing. Like I learned early on that authors love to talk about themselves. So I was turned down for interviews by... I can only specifically think of one person, but and then there are some that never got back to me because they were too big. But really, the only person, like one person said no. Everybody else said, great, let's set it up. And in that time, I realized I was meeting people and I was making an impression. And so when it came time, it was through my podcast that an editor at Orbit found me and said, hey, can we have coffee at Worldcon? And I feel like I tell this anecdote all the time, but I think it's important. And perhaps your audience is not my audience and they won't have heard it before. At that same Worldcon, I was interviewing Lev Grossman, who was up for the Sounding Award for Best New Writer. And we had a nice interview. We clicked really well. It was fun. And after the interview, we're chatting and he said, will I see you at the parties tonight? Yeah, you mentioned the loser's party. And I said, no, because the before Hugo cocktail party and the after Hugo loser's party is invite only. So nominees, presenters, they all get a plus one, but that's the only people who can go. And I said, well, no, I'm not nominated for anything. I'm not presenting or accepting an award. I'm just, no, don't. And he's like, well, you know, I didn't bring anybody. I have a plus one if you want to get into those parties. And I thought, wow, that's pretty cool. Thank you. And then it was at that party, I stood in line for a drink next to a person that I clicked with immediately. And we were chatting and having fun. And then I found out she was the senior editor, the boss of the guy I had just met with. And, you know, he ended up leaving the company. And so he passed my book to her and she bought it. So I keep telling people networking is like being tall and playing basketball. Do you have to be over 6 feet to play basketball? It certainly helps a lot, but you don't have to be, but you get it. You get a, you know, people who are very tall typically do better in basketball just because of the way the sport is. So like if you can network, that gives you that tall boost, I suppose. And I feel, you know, I sympathize with people who can't go to conventions for whatever reason, but conventions, because of COVID, are starting to do a virtual aspect to them. And I try to encourage my people who are too shy or too immunocompromised or in too far, too remote a location or just don't have the funds to try to go to as many virtual cons as they can, because they, the good con runners set it up to where you can listen to panels, you can try to meet people, not as easy as if you were there in person, but certainly better than if you hadn't gone at all.
Now, let me ask you about National Novel Writing Month, NaNoWriMo, as it's referred to shorthand. And I remember hearing you talk about it, I'm thinking, what is she talking about? And over time, it became clear. And that just ended. You you've participated for years, I think you said, Murr. And I think you said, I've never actually hit the target, but I participate every year. And the target, explain for our listeners what it is, what the target is, and why you participate. Even though you don't hit that target, you find value in it, obviously, because you participate every year. So tell us a little about that.
National Novel Writing Month is started with a challenge that Chris Beatty from San Francisco did with his friends. And that was, let's see if we can write 50,000 words in a month. And I guess November was coming up, so they chose November. And that was 9 people. And now it's a nonprofit organization that, has hundreds of thousands of people around the world taking part in it. Even though it's called national, it's definitely not national anymore. I fail every time. I don't know if it's a November thing. I don't know if, I don't know why. I feel like something comes up every time. Last year, my agent quit in November, and I was like really worried and upset and trying really hard to, I got to find another agent. How do I do that? I know how to find an agent when you're a beginner. I don't know how to find an agent when you're mid-career. And this year, I had some sickness in the family I had to deal with. And so anyway, it's like something always seems to come up in November. Why I love it is that it really encourages people to start something and put effort into it. It has been scientifically proven time and time again that persistence makes you better. Trying to do something perfectly does not make you better. And so the rule for NaNoWriMo, not the rule, but the workflow you need to accept is you got to accept every crappy word you write. You don't go back and delete. You don't edit. You can throw in as many flashbacks, as many adjectives, as many adverbs, as many dream sequences as you want. You can just get the words down. And I love it because it allows people to write poorly. And I think so many people want to be published. They think, I can't write crap. If I write crap, then it's not going to get published and it's terrible. Well, it might be terrible, but you're at least like, that's another step on the way to being published. And
what a lot of people don't realize is everybody writes bad first drafts. John Updike, I'm sure, did. I'm sure that Toni Morrison wrote lousy first drafts, but then you refine it. It's a process. It's a process of refinement or enrichment.
Yes.
And that's such, I figured you were going to say something to that effect, because the big challenge with people, the worst way to write is to sit at with a notebook or at a computer and just bleed the words out drip by drip, instead of allowing your mind to just break the dam open.
Right.
And yeah, so NaNoWriMo, I should say, you're basically committing to about 1,700 words a day, which is not extraordinary. I mean, when you think about it, it's a lot, especially when you're going to do it every day. But if you hit 1,700, of course, everybody's busy. But I imagine that an awful lot of people, the value is the same as what you realized, Murr, and that is it kind of forces you to just go ahead and get the words on paper, and then the refinement process begins. I mean, any fiction writer is going to throw away probably, I mean, if you're really working it, you're probably going to throw away 80 or 90% of what you're writing anyway.
Right. Learning that you can handle poor writing is a very key thing. And, but there's also the other aspect of NaNoWriMo that I love is the community. It's like writing is essentially a very private thing. And it's, you sit at your desk and you write, and you're pretty sure you're the only person in the world who's struggling over this project, because everybody else is updating the website with all the hundreds of words or thousands of words they've written that day, and you didn't. And so clearly, you know, you're the terrible person here. But with NaNoWriMo, you can find people who work at your speed. You can find people who've fallen behind like you have. And you can just go somewhere and get encouragement, because people who participate in this, everybody's doing the same thing. It's like we all have the same project, and that's get this many words in this time period. So you don't have to go somewhere and explain, I'm trying to do this thing, and then hopefully somebody will understand and give you advice. No, everyone's doing the same thing. So it's, there's a great sense of community. We have, I open up a Discord for my audience to go talk about NaNoWriMo, and the Discord has a wonderful, a lot of really interesting bots that you could put in there. And what I have is the, I have a couple of writer bots that will start a word sprint. So you can say, I want to see how many words I can write in the next 30 minutes, and anybody else can join. So you all say, y'all tell the bot, join this writing sprint. And then you all write, and then it tells you when 30 minutes are up, and then you put in your word count, and then you get to see like where you are in the list of people writing. And people find that very influential. Influential is the wrong word. Inspiring.
Inspiring, so, yeah.
The community aspect is huge. There's also forums on National Novel Writing Month's site. There's a site that cropped up called For the Words. That's numeral four. I love this site. I don't use it nearly as often as I should, but it has taken the act of writing and turned it into an RPG. So you get on
a rocket propelled grenade.
No, is that right? role playing game.
Role playing game. Okay.
Right. So you tell you tell the site that you want to, well, the site offers you various monsters to fight against. And the monsters represent a certain word count in a certain time. So you say, okay, I'm going to fight against this monster. And then you open up the browser for the site. Well, you're already open, but you go to the site, your personal area, and then you start writing. And at the bottom, you see where you are in beating the monster. And then when you write that many words in that amount of time, you say, oh, you killed the monster. Here's some loot. And since a lot of my audience are science fiction fantasy writers, people love that. So there are big monsters that you can only fight. Only during NaNoWriMo, but some of them are like 2,000 words in 2 hours or something. It's like they're really big monsters. And then there's the little ones, like 250 words in 30 minutes. And that turns out to be fun and also gives a big community aspect. Also loot drops, which motivates a lot of gamers. So there, the community, the point I'm trying to make in this roundabout way is the community is very strong around NaNoWriMo, and that is why I try to be involved every year. If not doing it myself, then at least supporting others through my podcast.
Do you work on a specific project when you're doing NaNoWriMo?
Initially, you were supposed to start a project, not necessarily finish it, because 50,000 words technically is a novel, but no publisher is going to buy a 50,000 word novel unless, like, you're already very established and amazing. It used to be that you had to start a new project, and that's not really the case anymore. They're just like, write 50,000 words this month. That's the only rule. So Yeah, I used to feel bad that I couldn't do it. And then I realized that I've already proven I can write a book. And I've proven that I can write a book quickly. And so I don't feel the it's now just become a joke, especially when my audience finishes NaNoWriMo and I fail. It's kind of a joke, so it amuses people. And so I do sign up every year with the intention to do it. I really do.
And do you have a specific project that you're working on? For instance, the successor book to the Ophelia Network, which we're going to talk about in a second. Would you be, or are you just doing experimental writing? You're picking a subject and you're doing it that way. Have you actually worked on a project? Not that you would say, okay, I've done my 50,000 or I got 35,000 and now I'm done, but you've created a lot of content that you then can go to work on.
I've been using it as starting projects that nobody has paid for and there's no stress to sell it. So I do like experimental writing as, you know, I'll see if I can work on a thriller or work on a romance or something, just do something new that is not currently no publishers waiting for, then the pressure's off and I can write whatever I want. So that is how I give myself permission to be bad because I'm trying something new.
Right, right. So let's talk about something you did that isn't bad. It's good. It's polished. It's a finished product. It's forthcoming. The Ophelia Network, a novella, which will be available when?
It'll be on Audible as an Audible original May 26th.
So it'll be audio only?
Yes.
Or will it? Okay. So the Ophelia Network is what? Tell us about your latest novella.
Yeah, the Ophelia Network is something I've been working on for a while, and I couldn't sell it as a novel, but then I reimagined it as a novella, and so Audible bought it. But the log line is Blue's Clues meets 1984, because I just wanted, I imagined a future with a fascist government where all communication was monitored and people didn't feel safe hardly with any communication. And so the rebellion starts sending codes through a children's television show. So it's from two points of view, the woman who's hired to put the codes into the show and the man who is the star of the show. And it's unclear whether he's aware this is happening or he's just like a stooge who's going to fall when the government figures it out. So, so it was very challenging to actually write beyond the outline. I had to do two full rewrites because I liked the concept was very strong in my head, but the actual story around it needed some fine tuning because, well, it's fun to say Blue's Clues meets 1984. What you're saying is, something whimsical and innocent during a dark future. And it requires a very delicate balance of cute and serious. So that was my challenge there. But I am very happy with it. The Ophelia Network is the poorly disguised Amazon Alexa? It's an Alexa, right. I have Alexa. Google Home, which is not nearly as cleverly named. But anyway, those digital assistants. So in my story, they're all called Ophelia. So that's what it's about. And it's coming out in audio. And that's the one with songs that I can't sing, so somebody else.
You'll be reading it other than the songs.
No.
You'll have somebody else sing it. Oh, no. You won't be reading it. Okay.
No, not at all. Unfortunately.
Okay. So, are you the kind of writer who you've got a bunch of future ideas in your head written down where you know what your next three or five projects will be?
Yes and no. I know what my next project's going to be because I'm contracted for it. So my next project kind of has to be this thing because it's, you know, I have an editor waiting for it, and more advance money will come my way when I turn it in. So there's all sorts of reasons to get it done. But I do have many ideas floating around in the back of my head that I try to work on during times of relaxation. Like right now, I'm just trying to relax and fool around with new ideas, and I'll be starting the new book in the new year.
You're in, what does it typically take you in terms of time frame? I don't know if there's any consistency to this, but your time frame for producing a book is typically, because I know you said you've written some books quickly. If you were to average it out, what would you say is your typical timeline?
I don't know. I really don't know how to answer that because, you know, the idea can be just wandering around in the back of your mind for how long? And then you could, is it from writing page one to writing the end, or is it writing page one, writing the end and having your editor sign off on it? I mean, I don't know how to answer that question. I know it's ridiculous, but there's so many different things involved. I try to write 1,000 words a day. So, notice I said try, but I am working on my new regimen, as we mentioned earlier. So, you know, goal is sit down early on, write 1,000 words, and then I can call myself done. If I want to do more, I can. But so 1,000 words a day would be about 3 months to write it. But that's like perfect world kind of thing.
Right. And then when you're talking about 1,000 words a day, that doesn't include your editing process after the fact. Yeah. So, I know you're busy and you've been really generous with your time, but before I let you go, and you've already given a lot of really great advice to the aspiring novelists out there, let me give you a chance though to just make any other suggestions you've got or a statement as to what you would recommend to that aspiring novelist or the novelist that's out there already published, but struggling, because it's always a struggle. It's not like it ever becomes simple. What are some parting words for that would inspire our fiction writers out there?
Part of the advice is persist. And this feels like something you put on a coffee cup. It's trite. It's things that everyone hears all the time and they really want to hear the secret bullet. But I studied as many creative writing classes as I could in college. And when I got out of college, I thought, okay, well, I'm going to be a writer when I grow up, but I got to get a job to pay the bills. I didn't write for 10 years. I did not write in my 20s. And only when a good friend of mine, well, now a good friend, but someone came to the company I was working in, and then he and his then wife bought a house down the street. And so we were seeing a lot of them, and he was a professional writer. And he's like, look, you just got to do it. You know, you can't wait for permission. You can't, if you really want to be a writer, you got to write and finish and send it in. And, if not for him, I don't know what I would have done, really, because he really just said, whatever you're waiting for is not going to come until you go out and get it. So I'm sad I lost those years, but maybe I needed them to grow up a little bit. I don't know. We'll never know. But I kind of wish I hadn't. I see these new novelists come out at like 23, 24, and I'm thinking, wow, you guys really just ran for the dream and grabbed it, and that's great. By the way, listen to your agent and don't spend all your advance in one place. But I've heard too many bad stories about young YA authors getting a six-figure deal and then wondering why they're broke in 3 years. But anyway, that's a different story. Persistence is the most important thing. It really is, because you'll teach yourself things. And the weird thing about writing is you can't know. It's hard to know when you've learned something. I got my MFA, and I can't tell you specifically what I learned, but I know I'm a better writer because of it. So as you write, trust that you're getting better because you are teaching yourself. So that's basically my advice. Don't quit. Yeah. Just don't.
There's a lot of fear involved in writing, and people are, you know, they're fearful that they're going to, as long as you're not writing, the dream is still alive. You start to write and you have dreadful first drafts. You start to think, I can never be a writer because I just suck at this. And again, it's what Anne Lamott said. Everybody writes a shitty first draft.
That's right.
And you know, beyond shitty, dreadful in some cases. I've said it before, but it's worth repeating. Jennifer Egan won the Pulitzer Prize with A Visit from the Goon Squad. And I heard her on a radio interview and they said, tell us about your writing process. And she says, well, I decide what I'm going to write my chapter about, and then I write the chapter. And of course, it's terrible. And I mean, she's a Pulitzer Prize winner. She's a celebrated authoress, and she's in the same boat as we are. So, what you say absolutely resonates, Mer. So my guest, obviously, Mer Lafferty, you know, her podcasts are terrific. Don't leave me for her. Just expand your podcast listening. She's got three of them. I Should Be Writing, Ditch Diggers, and Escape Pod. And then you can find her books everywhere books are sold. And she's also on Audible if you like the audio versions. And her new novella will be The Ophelia Network. And that's an Audible-only special. And so you can look for that one, which is coming up again. Mer, when will that one be released?
May 26, 2022.
Mer, thank you very much for taking the time. This has been great. It's so great to actually, I've listened to you and your voice for years, and to be able to actually interact with you has been great. So thank you very much.
It's been a lot of fun. Thank you so much for having me, Mike.